If you want to break your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 165, Electric Boogaloo. I'm Chris, and with me today is...
I am Matt.
And we're going to talk about electric vehicles. So, one of the big rumors lately in the electric vehicle market, I mean, obviously Apple has got a vested interest on the compute side of the electric vehicle market, and they've been talking, well, they had their own division that was doing testing of automatic vehicles with driving, and you know, supposedly they got broken up, but they seem to retain all the engineers on that. So, and then there were talks that Kia was going to partner with Apple for an electric car. And then, you know, now we're hearing that Foxconn, you know, Chinese company who, they're actually trying to diversify out of China, for manufacturing, but they're looking to build electric vehicles, and the rumor is that Apple is their partner in this, although they're saying that they won't confirm that, you know. But they did confirm that they have plans to build electric vehicles in North America by 2023, and they're looking at locations for their manufacturing plants in the U.S. and Mexico. So when the CEO of Foxconn was asked if it was... an Apple car that was being built, he said it was still a rumor. That being said, I would say that that's more likely a deal than the Kia deal was.
I'm not interested in an Apple car, and I'll tell you why. Because the moment they announced the Apple Car 2, the Apple Car 1 will perform at like 25% of what it was before.
Yeah, so instead of being able to go 60 miles an hour, you'll only be able to go about 40.
Right.
Yeah. it is interesting. I guess the U.S. location where they're looking to build a manufacturing plant is in Wisconsin, where I believe there was a Foxconn plant that was already purchased. So it would be interesting if that's what really happens. And more than likely, if they are going to really build cars, it's not going to be a single plant. I would think that it's probably going to be, if you're going to build North America, you're going to have plants in both the U.S. and Mexico. But, you know, it does make sense that Foxconn looking in that direction. You know, the smartphone market is, it's one of those weird markets, kind of like the PC market, where they're ubiquitous devices. And yeah, they're always going to be able to make money at doing it, but there's not going to be this massive growth because, again, the market's saturated, not only by them, but with, you know, with competitor products. And, you know, Foxconn, yes, they manufacture all these things, but you really have to look at it as that they're a logistics company. They provide logistics for electronic processors and parts. And moving into the auto industry would probably be a growth market for them. There's market for them to take away from other people, which would help them grow. You know, whether or not they're building cars themselves, but, you know, getting in that supply chain.
I guess here's my thing about that. What's different about this product versus any other car? I mean, what's the big deal?
Well, I'll tell you where the growth in the market is. So it's not so much in the car itself. It's in the logic in the car. So for Foxconn, it's not software, you know, because they're a hardware provider. It's not the software. It is getting into that supply chain so that I can be one of the manufacturers and suppliers of the control modules.
Okay, that's great, but you don't need to produce an Apple car to do that.
No, but for them to get in the market, they might want to get into a deal with somebody. I personally don't think Apple is going to produce a car like Tesla produces a car. I personally think what Apple is going to do is they're going to get in with some manufacturer where they get to influence not only the design of the car, but the logic of the car, the way it works and things like that. Because again, that's their place. Now, electric cars are much more rolling computers or mobile computers than they are automobiles. From a design and usage perspective. Well, I don't want to say usage, a design and...
But and, that's the point of a car, is yeah. the usage. This is what I keep coming back to. Why computer companies think they need to make cars is stupid to me. Just be the component.
Well, that I actually think that's what Apple is going to end up doing. I don't think many companies are going to go the route of so we know, and I'll tell you the whole I think electric cars are cool. I think what Tesla does in their cars are very, very neat. Do I think it's super necessary? I don't know that at least now or in the next 20 years that an electric car is going to be superior to a internal combustion engine vehicle. From a functional standpoint, they have wheels that roll. I get in and I drive it from point A to point B.
There's no innovation there.
Yeah. You know, it's fun to think about the fact that Tesla's trying to make Kit from Knight Rider back in the 80s. But won't that be the most annoying shit in the world?
Like, I don't have enough. I always have my GPS set to a female voice.
Yeah.
And it's because I know the damn thing's going to nag me anyway. It might as well be in a voice that's already nagging. The last thing I need is my car to do that.
I would much more think that Amazon would have built their own car than... you know, that way Alexa can tell you what to do. Stop sign ahead. There are train tracks ahead. Hey, that car's braking ahead of you. Alexa, shut up. I'm just trying to keep you alive. And then Alexa can, you know, interface back with your insurance company to say, he's a terrible driver.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't need any of that.
But, I think from an Apple perspective, I think what their interest in the fact that they had a car division was not to make a car, but was to perfect the logic of running the car, the brain. Because that's where the innovation is if they can get to the point where we have, even if it's not a passenger vehicle, but you have an autonomous vehicle that's doing things as simple as delivery. You know,
well, we already have that in some of our ports. We have autonomous vehicles that will take containers and move them around and take them to the various stations to be loaded and offloaded and all of that. We have all of that.
Yeah, but the problem is none of those systems typically, there's limited traffic. Both, you know, foot traffic from people and other vehicles in those ports where they're moving containers and things around. It's also a finite area that they operate in. And so the logic and how it works is a lot different. The sensor, they don't require nearly as many sensors to operate.
Do you honestly believe that there's going to be an autonomous vehicle system that will be able to operate on anything other than a smart road?
I do. And part of that's based upon some of the things that are already out there today. There's quite a few cars that they have enough sensors on them, which That's a whole nother discussion on cars and sensors, because most of them are cameras. But they have these sensors on them, and you know, as you approach somebody on the highway, if they throw their brakes on and the car thinks you're too close within a stopping distance at whatever speed you're going, it will back you off no matter how hard you press the accelerator.
Until you turn it off.
Yeah.
Which is what I do. In all the rental vehicles that have that annoying technology.
But at some point, I have a feeling that we're going to get government mandated into never being able to turn that off. You know, say, we're the government, we know better than you, and so we're going to save you from yourself.
That sounds like something that would happen during a time when our good friends, the Democrats, are running the table.
It's possible.
I can't imagine a Republican administration going along with that. But you never know. Politics aside.
True. So, I mean, it's something to think about. The other thing to think about is, so, SpaceX, with their Starlink product, which is getting really good reviews. I've done a lot of research on it. I had signed up to get information, and I actually got an invite to do the beta. But based on the early information, I thought the Starlink would be cool because I could take it with me. But they GPS lock it to your address. So I thought, I'm not paying $500 for the beta. I'll wait until the final product comes out. Because I already have good, fast, low-latency internet at home. I didn't need to add another $90 a month to my bill to then have a second, slightly less latent, or slightly more latent network connection. But I think it's a great product. I think it, one of the things that, I think the other cable providers or cable providers are a little worried about is that Starlink, because it is so good the way it works, provide and the pricing is right, that they now actually have some competition and everywhere, which I think is probably even more important.
Which brings up the really super sexy issue of rural broadband.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a really sexy solution to that political problem.
Absolutely. Well, there's a great YouTube video out there. I forget who the guy writes for. He's a tech journalist. And he and his wife moved out into the middle of nowhere in Vermont.
Yeah.
Because that was their dream to move in. And they couldn't get better than 2 megabit per second DSL. And so he originally got HughesNet. And within 2 weeks of having HughesNet, he got the invite to do the Starlink beta. So he pulled the trigger and did it. And so he compared both of them. And he said, you know, Starlink's a keeper. He said, yeah, is it perfect? No. Is it that much better than HughesNet, which is right now about the only other rural broadband internet issue or provider out there? And he goes, yeah, it blows HughesNet out of the water. And because he canceled HughesNet within the first 30 days, they gave him all of his money back. So at least that was cool about it. But yeah, it's one of those things. Starlink can definitely solve that. I think the other place where, and I think these cable companies are naive to think that they weren't going to get, at some point, get some real competition, you know? When Verizon actually rolls out 5G and AT&T roll out 5G, they're planning on offering home internet. Not,
I've already been hearing that.
Well, there are some places that already have it, and people are talking about it's good, you know, particularly in rural. And I think Verizon evidently, and I for the life of me, I can't remember where it was from. They evidently rolled it out in several rural internet areas because they got a grant to test it, you know, and those people are loving it because they've never had high-speed internet.
Yeah, ever.
Ever.
Yeah. I don't know. My fear with relying on cell phone providers for my internet is they will give you, and the cable companies do this too, but it seems to be worse with the cell phone companies. They will sell you a deal at $50 a month, and then you get the bill, and it's like $250. That's just crazy. There's no reason for that to wind up like that.
I don't know.
I'm exaggerating slightly, but
I haven't
get my point.
I haven't had that experience from my cell phone company.
Well, what it is they add on stuff that
Well, I will say this. Both the cable company and the cell phone companies, no matter which cell phone company is, I am not a Mint Mobile user who supposedly doesn't do this, and I'm air quoting here when I say doesn't, is that they have all the bogus taxes. There is no federal tax on this, and there's no federal tax on this. This is just a fee you're charging me. Yeah, they do that, but I don't know. I've had to have a cell phone for so long. I guess I've become savvy in understanding how, what my actual cost will be for what I'm getting. Now, what is unclear about, like, Verizon and AT&T rolling out this 5G is, like, if I have a family plan with unlimited data, is rolling out the home internet piece a separate plan, or can I add it to my family plan and only pay the difference,
Mm-hmm.
And one of the neat things Verizon has rolled out to be more competitive is you can have a family plan for unlimited talk and text, but you can then, each individual on that plan can have a separate data plan, but it all gets billed as a family plan, and it makes it a lot more economical. That way, if you need unlimited data, but somebody else doesn't because they never go anywhere, you don't have to worry about having to have unlimited data for everyone. Which actually reminds me, I need to go back to Verizon and adjust some of that, because I have somebody who has unlimited data, but they don't really need unlimited data. But going back to SpaceX, so they went back to the FCC to ask for a modification to their FCC application so that they can use dishes that are modified for vehicles, vessels, and aircraft. And what it is, although the filing says that Starlink terminals, which is really the piece that the FCC cares about, they don't care about the antenna. They care about the terminal because that's the radio that broadcasts back and forth.
Right.
That they could also install it on passenger cars. Now, SpaceX came back later and said, our intention is not to put them on passenger cars because the dishes would be too big to mount, but certainly on RVs and ships and semi-trucks and things like that. But I think that's actually probably planning ahead when they get a big enough constellation that they can possibly use a smaller terminal. Because, look how many cars have cellular broadband hubs built into them.
Right.
Because the cars need to talk to the internet. Much less, if they can get better throughput and offer greater options. Because, I certainly can see it on, like, an RV. But I can also see it on commercial trucks, too. Because they're starting to have to download so much data, not only to the truck, but then upload data from the truck. That they need some real internet connections for that. And that's probably where the growth in the majority of business would be to make SpaceX break even. Right now, the Starlink piece of SpaceX operates at a loss. Because even though they're charging $500 for these terminals, that's a fraction of the cost of actually what it costs SpaceX to manufacture those. But they're trying to get them in the hands. And I think that model is also going to be like, you don't really own the terminal and the dish. You do, but you don't. It's like early on in the cell phone days when they would subsidize the phone. You know, if you, yes, you own it after 5 years or you own it after 3 years, but the reality is you can, you know, a portion of what you're paying every month is actually the cost of that terminal and that antenna or the dish. But if they sold it to like a commercial fleet, they could get all that money up front plus profit, so that, you know, it would offset that, make that more. So I think part of it's a business decision. Part of it's also they see a need in the market for it. And it would also be certainly be an improvement over the satellite internet that they offer on cruise ships today.
Well, and airliners.
And airliner and trains.
Ugh.
So, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. You know, we talk about, in a way, we're part of the last generation who knew what it was. Well, we are really part of the last generation who knew what the world was like before the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Did DARPANET and the precursor to the internet exist?
Yeah, but you're talking normal people.
Yeah. You know, we talk about the Dayton Freenet. People look at you and say, what's a Dayton Freenet?
What's a Dayton Freenet? Yeah.
You know, well, for a long time, that was our only way to get email. Yeah. And you remember Gopher service. Gopher, what's that? Now, that was before HTTP. We do research over Gopher and go to all the universities to find digital reference information.
Well, and then you had to FTP files to your friends and,
oh yeah,
you know, all of that was just,
when it would take 8 hours to FTP a 720k floppy.
Yeah, the good old days.
We lived through all of that. Well, before you even got into computers, I was in them, and as a little kid even. And do you know what an acoustic coupler is?
Is that the thing with the phone where you, like...
It was the first modems were acoustic couplers. Yeah, you took the handset on your phone that had a dialer, not a...
That's the old CompuServe days.
Yeah, you would plug it in. Because so the acoustic coupler, part of the reason they got rid of them was because when they wanted to go to faster baud modems, you couldn't do it because the acoustic coupler was inefficient in that way. So I think you could only do, maybe on a good day, you could do 1200 baud, you know.
So my experience with that technology comes from a guy that my mom was dating. He was into CompuServe on his Trash 80, and you know, I mean, it's like that was the cool thing.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I remember using I think it was a 600 baud or 300 baud or 600 baud acoustic coupler with a PET, Commodore PET.
Yeah.
And logging into a BBS with it. I remember that.
BBS. Now that was the thing too.
Yep.
There isn't anything like that anymore, really.
Now, a lot of BBS has moved online, but I don't know if any of them survived, you know? I don't know.
Not really. I mean, AOL was really kind of a BBS.
It was.
But there really isn't anything like AOL anymore.
Well, no, why would there be? I mean,
well, Facebook is kind of like an extension of what AOL used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. So, one of the other things that's interesting is... So there was a big report, and Wired Magazine covered it, that came out of Lawrence Livermore. And it talked about... the Wired Magazine article is called "When the Electric Car is King, Less Energy is More." And Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, National Laboratory, they put out a report about essentially... electric cars, because, you know,
Is this the report that says that we couldn't manage?
So this is
the grid couldn't manage it.
Yeah. So here's the weird thing about the report. So the report has a lot of mixed messages, and I think part of it is because they didn't know how to. So the problem is they're trying to pander to the president, because Sleepy Joe decided that they wanted to electrify the whole the federal vehicle fleet, and he wanted to install federally subsidize the installation of charging stations all across the country. And Lawrence Livermore came back with this report, but I think they were caught between the actual scientific evidence and
the political reality.
The political reality. And so the guy who wrote the article asked a couple questions in the beginning, and he made a couple statements. Mm-hmm. He said, and the statements said, President Joe Biden wants to electrify the federal vehicle fleet. Then underneath that, he goes, well, Tesla Inc. just sold 500,000 plug-in cars and expects to increase that by 50% a year. And that's in North America. So last year, they sold 500,000 electric cars, plug-in vehicles. Now, what would be interesting to understand that is, so our population is roughly around 330 million people in the United States. How many?
Are we talking a 500,000 Teslas?
Half a million Teslas.
Cars.
Yes. Now, I think that was in North America. I don't think that is just the United States. So that would have to include Canada and Mexico.
But Mexico can afford a Tesla?
I don't know. The richest man in the world lives in Mexico. So there's...
Well, that's one.
There's quite a... Actually, Mexico has... They have a... Their society is probably much more divided in haves and have-nots. There's not like a middle or much of a middle class in there, but there's quite a bit of affluence in Mexico where people would afford that, and because part of the reason there's not so much middle class is because when you get to the point of where you're living in middle class in Mexico, you have to have bodyguards,
Fair enough.
And so there probably is, there's enough cachet with Tesla worldwide that there probably is a significant number of them in Mexico. I just don't know what those numbers are. Same thing as what specifically, how many were sold in the United States and how many have been sold since Tesla started selling cars in the United States. Which Tesla can tell you because all of those cars phone home. The other thing he said is General Motors and Ford, they're all working on larger electric vehicles. Like General Motors is looking at doing an electric Hummer. And of course, the big thing is Ford has been working hard on getting an F-150 with an electric motor out. Now, that alone, a pickup truck, a Hummer I can see. Because even though a Hummer is an SUV, it is not a practical SUV. And it's not one that a lot of people are going to off-road, not a brand new Hummer. They're made for soccer moms who want to be intimidating on the road.
So it's soccer dads.
Yeah. So F-150s, on the other hand, fleets of them are... It's the number one vehicle sold in the world. Fleets of F-150s are bought for commercial fleets. Duke Energy probably owns a couple hundred thousand pickup trucks.
Well, that's what I'm getting at.
So
these are fleet vehicles. They're not cars, is what I'm getting
but
at.
But even a fleet vehicle, part of the reason they own them is there two things. One, the people that drive them for the companies have to carry a lot of equipment with them. And that equipment equals weight. Now, an F-150 is a half-ton truck, so they're going to be potentially carrying 1,000 pounds or less. But it's still equipment, tools, material, because usually construction companies, when they buy commercial fleets, they're buying F-250s, F-350s, because they're actually having to haul some significant weight.
Sure.
You would be surprised how little it takes because I own both an F-150 and an F-350, how little it takes to put 1,000 pounds in the back of your F-150 and go, I don't know if I can make it to my destination. Well, we had an F-250 years ago, and we went over to the gravel place because we needed some gravel. At the time, we hadn't paved the driveway of our farm. And so up near where the driveway meets the road, you would spin out a little bit and it would throw the gravel. And we needed to replace a chunk of that gravel. And we went to get a half ton of that. Something granite. That you put out there, and the guy overfilled it by a little bit, and the back of the truck was doing this on the way home. And we were only driving, that was like 10 miles away, and we're like, man, this is tough. And that, you know, that was designed for a truck that typically are bought for that reason, you know, to be able to haul aggregate and things for small construction jobs. So, you know, that whole F-150 thing is an electric vehicle. I kind of question, because it's not going to be a farm vehicle. It have great torque because electric motors have great torque. So you'd be able to haul, you know, get a load moving, and you would be able to stop it. But you can't. There's no distance. You know, how far can, you know, will the batteries last, or a charge last you hauling, you know, a half ton of material, or pulling a trailer, you know, because, you know, you can certainly pull a lot more if the trailer can support it. But then the other issue is you got to worry about, is the trailer going to push you along when you try to stop or not? But that's another thing you worry about when you drive vehicles that can pull trailers. But I digress. So the other question the Wired executive or Wired guy asked, who wrote the article, is, so where's the power going to come from? And then he put some statements behind it, based upon what he read in the report. And it was, EVs are already greener than cars running on gasoline, even with our current electricity grid. Mass adoption only makes sense as part of a do-over of the entire energy system. So the question is, what will all power these plug-ins? And so what's interesting is...
So what's the answer? Did he have an
answer? And here's the surprising answer from the thing. Okay. Electrifying U.S. vehicles wipes out the equivalent of our entire power demand.
Well, of course it would. Which is why it will never happen.
So, and then he gets into the actual numbers from the report, you know. Like, U.S. consumes a lot of energy. Last year we consumed about 100 quadrillion BTUs. That's equivalent to 17 billion barrels of oil, which the author goes, which is, we'll admit, only marginally less abstract. But here's where Lawrence Livermore came in. Of that 100 quadrillion BTUs, only about a third of that ultimately is used in actually turning on lights and turning wheels and so forth. So for every, second law of thermodynamics says, for every unit of thermal energy we actually put into useful work, roughly another two end up as wasted heat. And then they go into what all the energy inputs, because all the numbers that Lawrence Livermore report was based on 2019 numbers, because of course it was done last year. What was interesting about it is, in U.S. energy inputs, all oil is directly goes to consumer segments. We don't use oil to do any electricity making in the United States. Now, there are other countries who burn oil, partly because they have a lot of it, to produce electricity. And actually, burning oil, one of the things they back in the 50s and 60s, they found out that if you ran your house off of like a V8 engine, including air conditioning and heating, that it was a lot more efficient than the current ways we were air conditioning and heating. Because that internal combustion that turns, you know, the combustion turns into mechanical energy, which then is turned into electrical energy has a lot less waste than like using steam or coal or nuclear. Well, nuclear is a weird one though. To heat water to then push and create mechanical energy, which then in turn turns a generator. And so that was one of the things. The other thing they said about 2/3 of energy input to create electricity generation is lost as heat. And again, and they said transport accounts for 70% of oil inputs. And it says that 0.1% of transport's energy comes from the grid. And then, and they go through all these numbers. And basically, what's weird about the report is, and they and this is where Lawrence Livermore, it gets murky, and because they forecast made based on assumptions. If we went to 100% electric cars today, we wouldn't have nearly enough energy to, and actually we would expend more energy if we tried to increase energy production on the grid, because again, law of thermodynamics, second law of thermodynamics, for every unit of input or output we get, we put 2 units of input in. We would not be able to power our transportation, our vehicle, personal vehicle or commercial fleet vehicle transportation system today. They look at where it gets funny is, so if they believe that solar generation in areas where solar makes sense, which is a lot more than most people think because the cells have gotten a lot more efficient, but then there's other issues you have to take into account, like areas that have snow. If your solar cell is covered with snow, you have to go out and clean it, because you still, the new cells will still generate electricity even if it's overcast. But snow is a physical barrier, like you can't get through that. If that generation rises 20% a year and wind raises by 10 and coal and oil generation drop to zero from 2019 to 2030, then, because again, the second law of thermodynamics does not apply in those cases, because we're not using some sort of steam or, you know, we're not converting heat into something that then converts to mechanical energy that then converts to electrical energy. And, you know, as oil generation drops, that we should be able to handle today's demand. The problem is when you read the report, you're one, there's a lot of assumptions that are made. Like, okay, if this happens here and this happens here from 2019 to 2030, then yeah, we'll be able to handle that. We'll be able to handle today's demand. But it doesn't talk about future demand. It doesn't talk about...
Here's an unintended consequence that I'm sure is not even addressed, because it's a soft science. As demand increases for energy of this type, the cost will rise.
Yes.
As well.
Well, the other thing they also say in their assumptions is that it's light duty vehicle energy demand, not. We're not talking about farm vehicles. We're not talking about real trucks, real pickup trucks, is what I call them. And we're not talking about construction equipment or trains. Because what everybody forgets, the United States is... It would be much easier if the United States as a whole was the size of Great Britain or the size of Germany and say we were going to switch to this, because one, if we were that size, we wouldn't have 330 million people. But the United States is large. I mean, physically large. The state of Ohio is bigger than several European countries combined, you know. And then we're not the biggest states. We're kind of in the middle, You get states like California and Texas, who are huge. So, you know, electric vehicle, I think, is going to be much more difficult to use. They talk about the efficiency of the electric vehicle, like an electric car or these light-duty vehicles are going to be able to match a combustion vehicle in range. And they're and by 2030, I don't have a doubt that we might have electric vehicles that can meet combustion vehicles' range today.
Yeah, but okay. In that time,
yeah.
How much further will a combustion engine vehicle be able to go?
And that's an interesting thing. You know, the car companies, now they're all switching to, because they see the writing on the wall of being regulated into selling electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when they were being regulated into meeting new gasoline efficiency rates back in the Obama era, we saw like heavy duty pickup trucks go from 7 miles to the gallon to 28 miles to the gallon. You know, that's a totally different one. So 28 miles on a 10 gallon tank means you got 280 miles to the gallon or to a tank. But most heavy duty vehicles have a 20 or 30 gallon tank. So you're getting 600-700 miles out of a tank of gasoline, you know, or tank of diesel. That's going to be tough even by 2030 with an electric battery. And again,
moving that kind of load.
Yes. Too. And these, yeah. So the other thing that this doesn't address, which is kind of weird, and like I said, it's kind of a mixed message. And I will say this, the Wired writer tries to twist it. So I actually had to go back and look at the U.S. Energy Report from Lawrence Livermore Labs. And again, I read the synopsis. I did not read the whole report. I just didn't have that kind of time or, you know, to sleep.
Desire.
Yeah. But
will.
That being said, you know, he's twisting it and making it look like a good thing, because in the report they do say, well, you know, we quit burning coal and we quit using oil and all of this, which, you know, potentially it's lowering greenhouse gases, pollution. But it really, if you read the report, it doesn't address that, because it's all about light duty vehicle. And he does in the article, he certainly talks about it being light duty vehicles in the assumptions. And so you're not eliminating the majority of pollution from vehicles, which is commercial trucking. You know, it's always funny, places where our commercial trucking hubs, Dayton, Ohio is a good example of that, have a really high pollution rate from vehicles. But it's not vehicles that are locally owned and operated. It's vehicles that are coming here to the distribution centers and dropping off product, and other vehicles coming in and picking up from those distribution centers to actually deliver it to the final space. But most of those vehicles are not registered in the state of Ohio, and Ohio does not get licensing fees or, all the incidentals that one pay for the infrastructure to have those vehicles drive on our roads or anything else. And yeah, you can say, well, that's what the toll road system is, or not toll road, but the way station system, they're supposed to pay their way fees and all this stuff. But I don't know how efficient that is. I have a feeling if you actually did an economic breakdown of vehicles who have to go in and get weighed, and then they pay the tax based upon the load weight of their trailers and their trucks, I have a feeling that runs at a deficit.
I'll take the under.
Yeah.
I don't know how all that works, but, you know, well, I haven't seen a way station be open.
Well, I don't drive by a way station in Ohio, but like, there's no way station from the river to I-70.
That's what I'm saying.
And there's no way station. There's no way station from I-70 west to the Indiana border in Ohio.
Correct.
There is one I-70 east to Columbus, yes. But I...
That's the one I'm thinking of.
I don't drive by that one. I mean, I might drive by that one once a year to know that it's open. Now, state of Tennessee on I-65 South, they have them as soon as you cross into the border. Same with Kentucky. There's one right on I-75 South if you're heading to Lexington. And it's just on the other side where I-71 splits off. And where I-71 splits off to go to Louisville, there's one right there. Those are always open. The ones in Tennessee, there's one right as you cross the border north of Nashville on I-65. And there's one right at the border as you leave Tennessee on I-65 into Alabama.
But I've been wondering if they aren't transmitting this data electronically somehow, and that's how they're getting...
Well, and how are they weighing it, though? Because they're not...
I don't know. And that's... But, to me, that's a big part. You know, we talk about the infrastructure problems we have in this state all the time. That's part of it. I don't think the way stations are open, for one, and two, I think they are operating at a deficit, and three, that's why our roads suck so bad.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, so back in the 90s, California EPA put out a report, and it actually got suppressed by request of the Teamsters Union, but the report said that a single semi-truck and trailer did the same amount of damage per year as 30,000 light-duty vehicles.
Would not surprise
on a highway. And so part of the EPA report in California, and the reason it got suppressed, was that they were saying that we need to change the licensing fees for trucks and weigh station fees for trucks in our state to account for the 30,000 to 1 ratio.
Now, here's the problem that I have with that, is what that's going to ultimately do is raise consumer prices for everything.
Yes. Now, I mean...
There are trade-offs in these things. So, I mean, well, I get that, but...
The one thing the United States we've done poorly on is... So, the cheapest way to transport something is by barge in the United States. The problem is barges can only go up major rivers. So, and that would largely only help the...
Yeah, but that's like 40% of our country.
I agree.
Okay.
But largely that would only help almost everything and things just west of the Mississippi River to do bulk transport. Because you can go east-west on the Ohio, you can go north-south on the Mississippi. And we actually transport a lot of stuff, particularly things like coal. That's how coal from West Virginia gets to St. Louis, Missouri, you know, to power some of their power plants. But we could actually do more transport of bulk goods because those barges can handle... Actually, I've seen on the Ohio down in Cincinnati, I've seen many barges that have the transport containers where they come from New Jersey, get loaded onto a barge, they're sent up the Ohio, and then they make their way north and south on the Mississippi. The second most efficient way for us to transport goods, and I think we have, because we're not investing in that infrastructure, it's not happening as much, is train. Now, United States has train, not commercial,
freight rail,
but freight rail is everywhere.
Huge, yeah.
And the way, this is where I think one of the things that would help infrastructure a lot in most states is if we use those to bulk ship things around, you know, use barges and trains much more efficiently than we do now. And then we take the European model of using box trucks to do final delivery. You know, because the box trucks don't carry as big axle loads and things like that. So, and frankly, they can deliver to rural places where, it's like today, a majority of our shipping in the United States, although UPS will tell you they're shipping it by air, which is not one of the most efficient ways. It's one of the fastest ways. But is they, you know, we get semis and they take things to distribution centers, and those distribution centers are typically on crossroads, hence why Dayton has many, many of them, because you have I-70 and I-75, so you're getting north, south, east, and west. Is then using smaller box trucks to ship goods to their final destination that have lower axle loads and stuff. It would be an adjustment in our consumerist society who, you know, we want everything in 2 days.
God bless Amazon.
Yeah. But, it's an interesting conundrum. When you talk about EVs, and particularly when you talk about, because, you know, it's probably one of the more directly, let me go back to another statement. Let me just say this. Everything is interconnected. Economics, politics, technology, application, you know, all of that. Looking at making a political statement that I want to electrify the United States for light vehicles and make that the way the majority of our people get transport across the country by 2030 is a great political statement. From a technological issue, is we don't have the infrastructure to do it.
The problem with stuff like this is every president since Kennedy has wanted to come on to TV and say, we will go to the moon and back within this decade.
Yeah.
And this ain't going to the moon.
No.
This is everyday life.
Well, my insistence on the whole thing is, do I think electric vehicles are bad? No. Do I think electric vehicles will eventually be the predominant personal transportation system in the United States? Yes. Do I think we should have government mandates saying that it will happen by this time? No. The market will decide when we go. And the thing that's surprising, and this is what I think some of these people don't want, because they think that by moving to electric, we're going to just automatically change how the environment works, and it's going to stop some of this other nonsense. Because that's the drive.
I'm not convinced how.
But market factors,
switching to that would impact our environment anyway.
I know. Well, market factors should determine when we go, and that's going to be determined on whether the technology is mature. It's going to determine how we roll out the infrastructure over time. It's also going to give, one of the things governments have got to figure out is, okay, if I switch from combustion, because it took them forever to figure this out in the first place. If I switch from internal combustion engine vehicles from the early 20th century and I have to maintain roads and infrastructure, how long did it take them before they figured out the road tax was going to be the way they were going to do it? So they were going to charge a gasoline tax at both the federal and the state levels, and in some cases local level, to cover that infrastructure cost. We're a little more forethinking of it now because there's, you know, like in Ohio, they haven't thought hard, I'll tell you that. But somebody has thought about it and said, and asked the question. And so to register an electric vehicle actually costs more than registering a internal combustion vehicle in the state of Ohio. But again, that kind of thinking or that kind of application might be the thing that turns somebody off from getting an electric vehicle.
Well, I think that kind of depends on how big the difference is.
Yeah. The other thing too is, so people were all over buying hybrids when the state of Ohio and the federal government were giving tax rebates based on moving to those vehicles. Nobody had a great experience with, particularly with the first Hondas. What were they? I want to say Civic, but it wasn't a Civic. It was a...
I don't recall.
But did they get an overwhelming number of people? You know, did they switch 10% of the market in the state over to hybrid vehicles? No. It's just now people are buying hybrids. And they're largely buying them not because they want to be any greener. It's because the fuel economy savings
warrants it.
Warrants it, yeah.
Well, and again, that's market forces driving those decisions, and that's the way it should be done, not by government mandate.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we beat this to death. We've beat it to death in other podcasts, but it, you know, as this goes along, I think it's an important topic to kind of keep on the front of your mind because it's going to affect everybody at some point. Just a couple other final comments on this. So one of the other things that the Lawrence Livermore report does not talk about is, okay, we're still producing internal combustion vehicles. We're going to still produce them until at least 2035. And I'm going to say that we'll be producing,
I'll take the over,
internal combustion vehicles long after that, but they won't be, it'll be questionable whether they will be light duty vehicles like passenger cars and things like that. If we stay on the current trajectory that, you know, we're on today. But what do we do with all the used vehicles out there? It's not like there's not going to be a fuel infrastructure required for gasoline and all of that. And you're sure as hell not going to get Shell and BP and all the jobber companies in the oil industry to want to give up that revenue either. And then even if that all went away and there was no, you know, there was few or it was specialty something, you know, to go buy 5 gallons of gasoline. What are we going to do with all of the vehicles that exist?
Well, this is where I come back and say that one of the things that's going to be part of this revolution is a conversion package.
Well, and here's the weird thing. So I looked into that too. So there's a company out there, and I looked at this 6 months ago, if not longer. They make... crate engine, electric crate engine replacements for vehicles. Now, I think they only had half a dozen vehicles that they were doing it for, but one of them was like the CJ, the Toyota, you know, SUV, mm-hmm. Was one of them. And they were all like SUV type vehicles. I think there might've been one or two car vehicles that they were doing it with, but basically it was an electric motor that you could drop in place and it would bolt up to your existing transmission. Because that's the thing, you know, electric vehicles don't have transmissions. They do direct drive motors. Teslas and most of them do that.
Right.
It's a different infrastructure. These use your existing transmission and it dropped an electric motor and then they would wire up. But it was ungodly expensive.
Sure.
It wasn't like it was... I figured, you know, it would be reasonable if it were $10,000 or $12,000. Okay, because one, these guys aren't going to be selling a lot, so...
But as the technology gets better, that price will come down, and
well,
eventually
it might be
feasible.
Yeah. Well, it might come down to where, you know, it's a couple $1,000, you know, $1,000 for the engine and $1,000 for the battery pack.
I dropped $2,000 on a refurbished engine in my car. I would spend $2,000 to switch to an electric.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't spend much more than that.
No, I don't think most people would, because, you know... When you get right now, this company is between $38,000 and $68,000 for a, and I'm like, none of the vehicles that you're offering these packages for
are worth that.
Are worth a third of that, you know, and so that, you know, they're hitting a niche market of people who have money.
Well, and they love their car.
That's right.
You know, and that's, there is something to be said for that. I think as we get to the 2040s, 2050s, there's gonna be people who like that retro style. They like driving their box on wheels, yeah, and will want to do that.
Yeah. Now what would be interesting, and I'm not gonna even talk about it because it might be a usable idea. So, But, you know, if there was some alternative to replacing the entire motor, you know, is there some way to retrofit an existing motor with an electric engine that would be a lot less costly, like replacing the carb and, or car, I'm talking older cars now, the carb and the header, but, you know, the fuel injection and the header, and being able to drive that, that engine with an electric motor, you know. There'd be some compromises there, like you'd still need oil to grease everything up, and so you'd have to have some system that still acted as an oiler system for the moving parts, and, you know, the more mechanical parts, moving parts, the less reliable it technically can be. That's questionable depending on who makes your electrics. But, you know, that being said, that might be a lower cost alternative. But, you know, the biggest cost is not the electric motor that's going to power that vehicle. It's the battery today. You know, go look up what putting a single power wall in your house from Tesla costs. And it's not as much as you'd think.
But it's still enough.
It's still enough. I mean, you know, to spend $10,000 or $20,000 on your residence that you own, that's worth, even if it's only worth $100,000, that's still only 20% of the value. So, you know, you're getting some value, or you're increasing the value more than likely by adding that. So, you know, the more your property is worth. But cars, you drive a brand new $60,000 car off the lot and it's worth $22,000 as soon as it's off the lot. Spending $38,000 to put an electric motor in it is not feasible. Well, we want to hear from you, our listeners, so please send us some feedback to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we will see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.